The Money Show.
Personal finance with Warren Ingram.
Over the years, I've had people rage at me often over the fact that we talk about investing and saving, and some people get furious because, well, they frankly don't have any money to do so. So how do you prioritize savings in a life that is expensive? How do you prioritize savings when you run out of money before you run out of month? And this is a challenge I put it to Warren Ingram, co-founder at Galileo Capital, personal financial advisor, a certified financial planner. Very few people can even afford to live a comfortable life when they've got an income, Warren, and they can barely, you know, make it through the month anyway. And we keep saying, you know what, you've got to save for your retirement. You've got to have short-term goals. You've got to have medium-term goals. You've got to put money aside to buy a car so that you don't have to buy it on terms. You've got to, you know, if you want to have meaningful time with your families, you've got to budget for holidays. You've got to make sure you've got a deposit on your home, and don't forget the insurances, and don't forget this and that. And before you know it, you've either got a blood nose or somebody's walked away in a huff and doesn't want to talk to you anymore. So how do we do this? How do we begin to resurrect our chances of financial freedom?
I think you need to be strategic, Bruce, when you look at this. And it's a little bit like when you arrive at the biggest buffet table you've ever seen. What you need to know is your stomach can't accommodate all the food on the table. And if you just start on the left and work your way to the right, you might miss out on some really juicy stuff that you would really like. And I feel it's the same when it comes to your savings. You certainly won't start out with enough money to be able to reach every single goal. And so you've got to be a little bit strategic based on your age, your stage of life, and also your personal priorities. So, to me, if you're really just kicking off your career, you've got to go. It sounds funny to say you've got to go safety first, because, you know, investment theory would say that, you know, the youngest people can take the most risk with their investments. And that's absolutely true. But you've got no backstop. You've got no emergency fund. You've got no safety net when you're starting out. So I think the very first thing you do is build yourself your own safety net, which means start with an emergency fund. And don't worry too much about anything else until you've got that up and running. So people like me will be telling you that you should save, you know, 15 to 30% of your salary, and that's before tax. And you should be, you know, investing for the long term. And all of that is true. However, what you need to do first is take care of yourself, protect yourself, and form your own insurance fund, your own safety net. And that's your emergency fund. And I think that, you know, if you want a number, it's going to be somewhere around half a year's expenses, or at the least three times your monthly expenses. So somewhere between 3 to 6 times your monthly expenses, put that in a money market fund, and start making sure that you can look after yourself when life happens. And it's amazing, when you don't have an emergency fund, life happens every single month. And the moment you get a decent emergency fund, life leaves you alone for a little while. And that's what you need, is you need a bit of breathing room. And that's the point. Get the emergency fund, look after yourself, and then you can start to focus on the more interesting, fun, and exciting stuff. And, you know, so kickoff number one, emergency fund. Number two, if you've got yourself into a bit of a debt hole, and a lot of people will have that problem, then take care of the most expensive, the highest interest debt that you have first. So don't worry too much. Once you've got the emergency fund, if step two is you've got a lot of debt, then don't focus on the investing. Don't just ignore it for now. What you need to look at is your credit card.
Warren, just pause for a second. What I find so interesting is you're saying, you know, you've got this high interest bearing debt, but the first thing you do is to create the emergency fund. I would have thought the first thing you do is to get rid of the debt, but you're putting it the other way around. And I'm curious as to why you would create the emergency fund in an environment where you're paying for high cost debt as well at the same time. That's compounding the difficulty, isn't it?
It might be, but it's the safety net you absolutely need when things really go wrong. If you focus on debt only, and you've got no other financial backstop, what's going to happen is you're inevitably going to hit a financial emergency and you go deeper into debt. The ability to kind of build up, firstly, the discipline. So this is also a little bit about self-education and forming a new good habit, which is setting aside money that you don't spend, that builds up and starts to compound in your favor. And then focusing on debt as a second step, what it allows you to do is kind of just get to the point where you know you've got some kind of a financial backstop. The next time something goes wrong, you're not having to then add to debt. You go straight to your emergency fund and you settle the financial emergency while you continue paying off the debt. I'm not suggesting that you build up your emergency fund and you entirely ignore your debt either, Bruce. I think it's about making sure that you're paying off the minimum required, but then get that safety net going as fast as you possibly can.
But it's and again, a lot of people, this is where people get cross. They shout at me, they don't shout at you. They say, but you said, and no, I didn't, it was Warren, and they don't believe me. It's a really hard thing to get your mind around, Warren, because life is expensive, has become more expensive, and salaries haven't kept up with inflation, and people's lives are tenuous. It's a really tough thing to do. So where does your mind need to be before you even begin this process? I think you've just done the book on psychology and money and getting your mind right. And I know you're not the psychologist. We're going to talk to your psychologist friend about the book in a short while. But it's just that sense of helplessness in the face of so many obligations to get ourselves onto a firm financial footing, which puts many people off before they even begin because it feels impossible.
I think a lot of big goals and a lot of important things in life feel that way before you start. And it's not that, we kind of discount how difficult life is at the moment and especially around money. What we're saying, and I'm putting words in your mouth here, Bruce, because I think you'd feel the same, is you simply don't have the choice to give up. You simply cannot use that as one of your options, just to throw your hands up and kind of let your money troubles overwhelm you and take you down to the point where you can't recover. If you want to exercise control of your life, if you want to be in a position where you are the master of your own destiny, not the master of your own disaster, then it starts with one small little attitude change, which is all of this stuff is within your control if you take a few small steps at a time. And one of them, the most important, is understanding that, these money difficulties are always going to be there. You're always going to be faced with scarcity where you're going to have to prioritize. And when you're in that position, you need to find a reason to take these actions. You need to find some kind of core calling that moves you forward. And for some people, that might be family. It might be that, they're about to have a baby and they don't want to bring a baby into the world when they're in a family that's, faced with overwhelming financial difficulty. It might be that you kind of want to launch your own charity one day. Whatever the thing is that's really important to you, you need to find that and focus on that first. That needs to be the thing that when you wake up in the morning and you get up to go to work and you hate your job and you know that you kind of struggle financially, this is the thing that kind of drives you to make these not big decisions. They're small decisions. And it'll be, for example, I'm trading off, that third coffee of the day and I'm going to rather put that into a bit of extra debt payment. And if you do that every single day, guess what starts to happen? Or I'm just not going to go out, and kind of spend my money at restaurants and bars and whatever it is. I'm going to have, friends around and we're going to share a meal cost together and we're all going to bring something, or I'm not going to do takeaways. I'm going to kind of cook at home and do bulk meals. There are decisions you can make, small actions you can take, nothing earth shattering.
Yes.
If it was rocket science, I wouldn't be talking about it every week. It would be someone far more intelligent than me. All of this stuff is simple to understand, not easy to do, but there are decisions you have to take. Your choice is, don't listen to this and say, yes, but life is hard. Of course it's hard. That's why only 5 out of 100 salary earners retire comfortably. But they're not geniuses. They're not big salary earners. They choose differently from the rest of us. And they make simple choices every single day because something drives them to make the better choice. And that's what we're talking about.
It's, yeah, the mindset that you go into this with, and people go into, and a lot of the, particularly the Americans, talk about the sacrifices you need to make. And I'm not too sure that the language of sacrifice, although it is a sacrifice, I'm not too sure how we talk to ourselves about this, how we think about this is as important as how we tackle it. And the actions that we take. If we are go into this thinking it's all about sacrifice and taking away, I don't think we have a sustainable means of putting money away for the longer term because we keep feeling as if we're missing out. And if we keep looking at the benefit of what we're doing and the advantage of what we're doing and keep a very close watch on the progress that we make, I think it becomes a lot easier to make those changes. I would nearly say sacrifices. Make those changes that they no longer feel like a drudge. It's not that you haven't been to a restaurant this month. It's like you've had your mates around at your house twice and you've been to their houses 6 times. It's been awesome sort of thing.
Absolutely. And there is no sacrifice when you're working towards something that's really meaningful to you. You know, if it's totally meaningful, if it gives you fulfillment to have that third or fourth coffee, and it gives you no fulfillment to drive a fancy car, then that's the decision you're making. Those are really constructive, really positive choices that you can make. I know a lot of people are going to be faced with much tougher choices than the one I'm describing now. But the thing here is, you can't be defeatist when you start. You have to look at this and say, I'm on a one page kind of plan. I'm going to look at what's really important to me, and if it's, you know, maybe it's travel, maybe it's holiday that really motivates you. And it doesn't have to be anything fancy. It could be something really simple. And if that's what's really important to you, then give yourself the goal of saying, you know, if I can knock my debt down by 100 Rand a month extra, I can take another 100 Rand and put that towards a holiday. You know, it can be really basic, really simple, and nothing else. You don't have to focus on anything else. Just do that for a period of time. And every month, look at that goal and see how it's growing month after month. And, you know, it kind of share it with your friends that, you know, not the details of how much debt you've got and how big your holiday budget's going to be, but just that you're setting a new goal. And if you're surrounding yourself with friends who are, you know, deeply depressed and telling you that everything's impossible, you need to find some other friends as well. You know, surround yourself with people that have an attitude that's different to that, you know, that are in a position of building their lives. You read some books, listen to the show, listen to the people that kind of make a difference. Their attitude is the thing that distinguishes them from everybody else. You know, pessimists didn't build the world. You know, they're not the ones that launch rockets, you know, and if that's going to be your attitude to money is, gee, everything's about what I can't do, then, you know, enjoy life on the ground while you know, the rest of the optimists actually make a plan and get themselves going.
Pete Mouton, chief executive of PSG at one of their big conferences at Sun City the 1 year, negative people never build anything. And it is the simplest, most wonderful expression of why optimists rule the world and pessimists, I mean, you know, you need pessimists in the world. They balance things out. What was the line I heard the other day? The optimist builds the aeroplane, the pessimist builds the parachute. Both are necessary. But yes, if you have a more pessimistic mindset, you are going to struggle to make the changes that are necessary. But it's that goal setting and it's focusing on the goals and the outcomes of those goals. So you want long-term goals, you want medium-term goals, I'm sure, but you also need some of those short-term goals, Warren, so that you can see the actions you're taking being fulfilled almost immediately, and you're not waiting till December to treat yourself to the holiday, putting all your money into a holiday fund so you can have the best holiday ever. But by the time you get to November, you've actually been hospitalized for stress and exhaustion, and you miss your flight anyway. And nobody needs that in their lives.
You're absolutely right, Bruce. And I think it's about finding things that give you meaning and fulfillment, you know, things that you can do with your money. And you know, very often it's the very opposite of material things. It's about experiences. And for some people, it might be, you know, kind of buying an extra bag of dog food for the SPCA every month and kind of going there and delivering it and seeing the impact. And for others, it might be helping firefighters that kind of, you know, slog their way through the whole of summer. You know, it could be anything. It could be buying some books for kids at school. If it gives you fulfillment, and you see your money at work, you know, then that might be a goal. If it's giving your child, you know, an extra opportunity that they might not have had, without the money, then that might be what works for you. But I think it's about making sure that what's meaningful and important to you and fulfilling as a human being, that you make sure your money is working towards that. And you're right. It's not about, you know, sitting down at the age of 25 and setting aside all of this money to your 60-year-old self. That's not going to help anybody. The likelihood of getting there is very small. So it needs to be, you know, incremental goals. And at the same time, you know, setting aside a bit of money for your future self as well. It doesn't matter if it's just 50 Rand a month. For your 60-year-old self, do it anyway. But in the short term, give yourself other goals that are extremely fulfilling. And all of these are really positive, constructive choices if you look at them the right way. And for some people, most amazing thing is, you know, I spoke to a young couple and they're entirely motivated by their wedding and their wedding is going to be 5 years away, but that's what they're focusing on. And that's kind of the most important thing to them is they want to have an incredible wedding and they don't want to start life saddled with debt.
Okay. They don't want to start life saddled with debt, but have you talked to them about eloping? And just like have that mindset of saving for a wedding, but don't spend it on the wedding. Put it into something useful. One day. Oh, my goodness me. The amount of money people spend on weddings. Anyway, let's not go down that particular avenue because I'll get myself into trouble. But yes, making sure that you've got that emergency fund, paying off those very big debts, then getting some financial goals in place and getting a sense of fulfillment. And then only your phase four, Warren. And this is maybe, you know, if you've done this over a year, this is in the fourth quarter of the year. Start to really heavily think about retirement and taking anything that is, you know, that you can afford and ensure that you are placing that into long-term savings.
Absolutely. I think if we just kind of quick recap on phase one is, you know, the safety net and then phase two is, you know, getting rid of that high interest debt. Phase three is the, you know, the goals, the shorter term goals that give you fulfillment. Phase four might be multi-years away where you start to then allocate, you know, your salary increases, for example, you know, to your long-term retirement goals, and building up, you know, that financial freedom number. So it's just a case of saying, if you can't do it this year, that's fine. You know, if you get a raise next year, then take that raise and set that money aside for the retirement money. And that's the long-term high growth assets that you want to build, and let those compound on themselves. Don't worry about them too much. You know, keep focusing on the fulfillment goals. And making sure that you don't get yourself into new debt. And over time, you know, just kind of revisiting these phase one to four again and again and again, year after year, watch how these big impossible goals suddenly become more and more approachable, more and more easy to achieve. And you'll have done nothing remarkable from an intellect point of view. This is not, as I said, it's not rocket science. It's just about building little habits, changing the attitude, and then getting up and doing it again tomorrow. And that's the key in this whole thing is be consistent and, you know, and stay focused on what's important to you.
I love questions like Sean's question. Thank you, Warren, for all of that. But I love questions like Sean's question at a time where we've seen the gold price rally about 20% this year and it's sitting at record levels. And it's wonderful to see gold shining again. And Sean is worried about the chaos in the world. He sees that gold is doing well. Is it a good idea to put some money into gold? And if so, how much money should I allocate to gold? Lots of money 6 months ago. How much now?
I don't know many very wealthy people that have made their fortunes from gold. I know lots of people that are really clever about investing in gold after the gold price has gone up, but not so much before then. So that's the controversial statement. And if I look at how the really wealthy, you know, intergenerational families have allocated money to commodities like gold, it usually limits itself to somewhere around 5%, maybe at an absolute maximum 10%. And in their lives, it's the ultimate insurance policy. They certainly don't view it as a major investment that's going to generate them, you know, generations of wealth into the future. It's the money that they've got in store just in case, you know, those doomsday preppers are right and the whole financial system implodes one day. But if you're not in that position and you're still accumulating capital and this is an asset allocation decision, my primary answer is, you know, unless you've really got a lot of money, kind of ignore gold and don't worry about the broken clocks, you know, that are right twice a day where they, you know, they're going to be right about gold every 5 or 8 years or whatever it is. And they're all going to tell you, I told you so. And then they'll be wrong for another 4 years until the next time gold is strong again. But in the meantime, gold does nothing when you hold it. It pays you no interest, no rent, no dividends. It only goes up because someone else is more fearful than you and decides that they'll pay you a higher price than you paid for your gold. And for me, that's kind of a dead asset. And I don't really see the value of holding a lot of gold when you're trying to accumulate capital. If you're sitting on a fortune and your aim is to protect your money and to protect it against as many risks as you can't think about or can't foresee, then sure, buy some gold as a ultimate defense or an ultimate insurance policy. But for the rest of us mortals that are trying to build our money and make sure it grows faster than inflation, I wouldn't allocate a heck of a lot of money to gold. And I'll smile and kind of nod when the gold, bulls tell me how amazingly they're doing because, they're doing it in from a position of I told you so. Once the perfect hindsight has come and gone, they really are right, you know, every day of the week and every month of the year.
That is a strong and controversial statement, Warren, particularly as gold looks as attractive as it is. But that is the reality, Sean, that you need to hear, I'm afraid. And it does, yeah, it does depend. And I suppose if you've got $1 billion in assets, you want $100 million spare, and you put that into gold. That means your family, you know, you can rebuild family wealth in the next upcycle if all hell does break loose. But for the rest of us, gold as an asset, nice to have, nice to hold. But sometimes it's better sold. That's the best rhyme I could come up with. That's it for The Money Show for this evening. Thank you, Warren Ingram, Certified Financial Planner, Director at Galileo Capital, for joining us this evening here on the Tuesday evening edition of The Money Show.